Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, legal analyst and author Elie Mistal discusses his book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Man's Guide to the Constitution, with Professor Ivy Wilson. The following conversation originally took place May 15th at the American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director at the American Writers Museum. I want to thank you all for being here for this program of the American Writers Festival, for joining us here today and allowing us to celebrate American writing, past, present, and future, safely and in person. This program, like many we've presented today, is offered in conjunction with the AWM's upcoming exhibit and content initiative, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. A member of its curating team and AWM board member, Dr. Ivy Wilson, is here to talk with legal analyst and justice correspondent for The Nation, Elie Mistal, about how the Constitution and the country's slaveholding past is used to deny people their rights today. Elie is an Alfred Knobler Fellow at the Type Media Center and the legal editor of the More Perfect podcast on the Supreme Court for Radiolab. He's a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, the former executive editor of Above the Law, a former associate at, I'm going to butcher this, I apologize, Debevoise and Plimpton, and a frequent guest on MSNBC and Sirius XM. The author of Allow Me to Retort, he lives in New York. Dr. Wilson is an associate professor of English at Northwestern University and the author of Spectres of Democracy, Blackness and the Aesthetics of Nationalism in the Antebellum U.S. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage.
It's a real delight to be here. Especially honored to play a small part in the amazing work that the American Writers Museum has been doing for years now here in Chicago, and I'm grateful for Allison and for Carrie for really shepherding this really wonderful festival together, along with our board members who helped inspire us. Talk a little bit about context here. Elie's book is more than a little bit of a kind of firebrand, if you will. He doesn't trade in subtleties. But the arguments belie being overextended, and that's a really difficult position to be in. Like, there's to pull no punches, but also to not be overwrought. And I'm going to talk a little bit about context in a moment, but it'd be remiss if we actually didn't start with Buffalo. I mean, I think it's present on our minds. You have a chapter 3, specifically, that is on the Second Amendment, and there's this really magisterial and disturbing phrase that you use in describing that moment in 1977 where the NRA has a conference in Cincinnati, and it shifts the NRA from this kind of, what's the phrase you I do remember the phrase you use. You can say it. I think it was Bambi killers.
Yes, relatively benign association of Bambi killers.
Relatively benign association of Bambi killers, or marksmen, or sharpshooters, or whatever. But then it shifted to something where the Second Amendment, you write, becomes the gospel for a certain faction of the Republican Party. So can you just say a little bit more about what you think is happening in the context of the NRA and gun violence in the U.S. and I think in this really disturbing moment of Buffalo from just yesterday?
Absolutely. Thank you for doing this, Ivy. Thank you so much for everybody for coming. I know it's late, so I'll try to keep everybody awake, at least until the drinks start flowing. Thank you so much for coming and for having me. Yeah, so when you look at Buffalo, here are just some truths that we have to be able to tell ourselves, okay? America is not the only country with a white nationalist problem, all right? It's not the only country with white supremacists. It's not the only country with disaffected male youths, all right? What it is the only country that has a Second Amendment. And that is why it's the only country that regularly sees these kinds of mass death explosions in the Western industrialized world. We are the only one because we have a ridiculous understanding of gun rights in this country, and it goes back to the Second Amendment. But it doesn't go back to the original Second Amendment. Do not let anybody tell you that, because that is a lie. The Founding Fathers, and I have, if you read the book, a lot of issues with the Founding Fathers, but they weren't that dumb as to think that the right way to run a country was unfettered firearm access for everybody to shoot anybody else whenever they needed to. That wasn't the idea, that wasn't the plan, that wasn't what the Second Amendment was for, and it wasn't how the Second Amendment operated for hundreds of years, or almost 200 years in this country, until the NRA metastasizes the Second Amendment into what we know now. And what we know now of the Second Amendment is that it grants this kind of overarching right to self-defense, right? That you have, look, the right to self-defense is a thing. Like, they're not constitutional reasons. There are philosophical reasons why the right to self-defense is inherent in almost any system of government. But the right to armed self-defense is something completely different, and something that the NRA made up in the 70s. And that Antonin Scalia, kind of head of originalism, the big brain behind originalism, him and Robert Bork, gave voice to, finally, constitutionally, in 2008, in a case called D.C. versus Heller, where Antonin Scalia, the alleged originalist, invented for the first time a right to bear arms for self-defense that had never been articulated in American history before. The real history of the Second Amendment, and this is one of the subtleties that I try to get people to understand. You can argue that the Second Amendment is generally working as intended, because the intent of the Second Amendment was to have white people kill black people. That's why it's there. The actual reason why they wanted it, because remember, the people who wrote the Constitution, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, they're rapping,
Thomas
to
Jefferson
each other.
Too, maybe.
Right. They didn't think the Constitution needed amendments. They thought they were good. It was what was called the Anti-Federalists, a group of people who thought the Constitution needed to have some rights to secure, that needed some rights to be secured. And one of those guys was Patrick Henry, and another one of those guys was George Mason. Mason was the governor of Virginia at the time the Constitution was being debated and ratified. And Mason and Henry, they give these speeches where they say explicitly that they need the Second Amendment because slavery is detested in the North. Now, if you know anything, I'm from, my people go back to Haiti, all right? Now, let me tell you something a little bit about slavery, right? It's really hard to hold people in bondage against their will unless you have numerical and military superiority over those people, something the French in Haiti learned the hard way. Now, in America, for the most part, the white Southerners outnumbered and outgunned the slaves in almost every plot. But in certain places, especially in pockets of Virginia and pockets of South Carolina, those numbers didn't hold. And the principal way of putting down the slave revolts in the olden days was the well-regulated militia. They would call up the militia, send them to wherever the revolting plantation was, and put down the revolts. That's how they did it. So people like Mason and Henry explicitly say that they are worried that that if the federal government has the right to bring up the militia and not the states, well, that the northern states won't vote to bring up the militia to put down the slave revolts. And so the South needed the Second Amendment to be able to train and discipline, that means train, their own militia forces to deal with their slave rebellions. That's why it's there, folks.
One of the really amazing parts of this book, relative especially to American political history, and one of the keen insights you make is that rereading of one of the most iconic figures, Patrick Henry, along with George Mason, and you point out that it was a necessary failsafe against anti-slavery activism. Can you say a little bit more, not so much on the kind of the militia side, but the law, or de facto law, or the incursion, the invective that's most known about the Constitution relative to African Americans is a so-called Three-Fifths Compromise. And so, and that's an issue that essentially kind of rendered fractional, if you will, black persons, to kind of allocate them for judicial purposes within Congress. And so what's happening there at the level of the Constitution?
Think about it this way. Who wanted the Three-Fifths Compromise? Who wanted to count African Americans, enslaved humans as 3/5 of people. It was the South. The North wanted 0/5, right? They're enslaved. They don't have any rights. Why should they count for representation? The South, no, no, no. They wanted to count them as kind of people so they would have more representatives from Southern states in Congress. But they didn't want to count them as full people because that would be hypocritical. And so 3/5 became the compromise that the slavers wanted to secure their rights in Congress. I can't, like, it's hard to, when you really kind of break it down, it is just the cojones on these people, right? Just the hubris on these people to demand representation in government on the backs of people they were enslaving by counting those enslaved people as kind of quasi almost people-ish for the purposes of representation. That is the 3/5 compromise. There are so many compromises written into the Constitution explicitly for the preservation of slavery. I've talked about the Second Amendment. We can talk about the 3/5 compromise. I didn't bring it up in the book, but I wasn't thinking of it in these terms when I was writing it, but like, there's a fugitive slave clause in the Constitution. Like, people think of the Fugitive Slave Act as one of the incitements for the Civil War, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. That just enforced a clause that was literally already in this Constitution, that that property had to be returned to its owner, right? So like, concessions to our slaver racist past, and I haven't even gotten into the misogynist past, right? There are all these concessions to how this particular group of white, wealthy, landholding colonists wanted their country to be. They knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to erect a Western slave empire, and again, I can say a lot of negative stuff about them, but stupid is not one of them. They knew what they were doing.
With kind of characteristic verb, he's opened up a kind of Pandora's box, one of them being voting and the slavery cause, of course, which is a famous one from the 19th century. There are a lot of really important parts, kind of broader strokes of the book. We won't be able to get to all of them in our particular conversation, but we do really welcome questions during a Q&A. There are some especially timely ones, obviously, the discussions around the Second Amendment in the context of Buffalo. But Ellie also has a chapter on voting rights and the Electoral College, women's reproductive rights and abortion as well, which is also obviously quite timely as well.
Just at the moment.
Not just at the moment, but always, right? As you point out. We've already kind of veered into some of the aspects of the argument of the book, but I wonder if you could say just a little bit about the craft of writing and what your process is like. For those of you who have a chance to read the book, and I encourage all of you to pick it up, it's a really, it's an easy read and it's an illuminating read, and that's a pretty great pair. But one of the kind of architectural features of, of about 6 of the 7 chapters, Ellie begins with a really complex thinker, someone like Socrates or someone like Hobbes. And then a couple of pages later, it gives us a reference to Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? Or gives us a reference to Iron Man and
Captain America.
Captain America. Sorry, haven't been watching Marvel. But it takes a lot to actually to throw those figures out there and to kind of put them into orbit. And so when you link up Hobbes and Iron Man, or when you link up Socrates and Obi-Wan Kenobi, like, how does that work? How does that work in your mind as a writer? And how do you put that on paper?
Right. So the trick, the skill, I believe, when talking about law, is to be able to explain it to people. The law is complicated. I'm not going to lie. Like, it is a complicated field, but it is not beyond the reach of most intelligent people. And so the entire skill, if you're going to be a law talker person, the entire skill is to take this complicated thing and explain it so that intelligent people can follow along. Otherwise, what are you doing? Right? And so you see a lot of lawyers on TV and writing. People who I like to say, not well-educated, but expensively educated. who kind of like want you to see all that money that they spent on their brains, right? And so they want to use the jargon, and they want to use the complication. They want to use the complication often to obfuscate what they're doing, right? And to make themselves appear to be very, very smart, and you little people cannot even possibly understand why women must be treated as incubators today. You can't even, how dare you, right? And we shouldn't be doing that, right? We should be putting the law where most people can get it, and I try to put the law where most people can get it without dumbing it down. Like if you go into the, as you pointed out, if you go into the Socrates analogy, if you go into the Captain America analogy, I don't dumb it down. I'm just trying to explain it through analogy, through reference, through whatever tool I have in my bag to get people to understand what's happening. Because I honestly believe, it's a big reason why I wrote the book, I honestly believe that if more people understood the law like I did, more people would be as angry about the law as I am, and therefore more people would be motivated to change the law as I am. That's the whole game. That's the whole point, right?
Let's play a little game here. So I was just kind of on obfuscation and unnecessary words. So in about the first third of the book, where Ellie is talking about police violence, I scribbled in my little notepad. The subject is absolutely neutral, according to Ellie. They just get instrumentalized as auxiliaries to reify power in the hands of a certain kind of regime. Those were my notes. His translation, or his initiation, was, my issue is when white people refuse to help keep their goddamn cops on a leash. Which is pretty straightforward. So can you just walk us through, that's a pretty strong invective and right. Almost polemic.
So there's the other part of my process, right, is that I kind of, and this is just from a writer, I would not, if you're a young writer out there, I would not suggest doing it this way, it's no way to live. But the way that I do it is that I almost think of myself as a spring, and I kind of compress myself, right? I focus in on one issue or one thing, and I kind of get as angry as I possibly can about it, just as tight and as, and then I explode it onto the screen. It's like, what? And then we edit. Right? But like the fundamental kind of fulcrum of it is this, like, this process of like anger and explosion, and then you kind of almost like you're throwing paint against the wall, and then you're trying to see, okay, what's the picture now from all, like, these are the, because I, again, from a, this is again purely process-wise, if this is what pissed me off so much, then this is what I need to convey to other people to get them pissed off at it, right? And so then the rest of the chapter, the article, the whatever, is kind of around, like, this is where I need you to emotionally be by the time we get here. And then the editing is just trying to get you there, right? So that's how you get that line. I like painting the picture. I like the visuals that I'm trying to use, because I think when people, and especially law, again, lives up here for too many people. Like, lives, like, they're just heads on sticks who are just saying things down to the people, and like, that's not how it is. And I want people to be able to kind of grab on and see what's happening. And so I use a lot of like flowery kind of imagery to try to get people just to see it. And then once you see it, then I can explain it. Right. Once you see it, then I can be like, okay, now this is how we got here, or this is how we get away from here. But you have to see the problem as I see it, and that's the process. It's very, like, you know, again, I don't suggest to young people to do it, because it's very kind of all consuming sometimes, and you know, it's hard for me. Like, it's like, if you see me on TV, if you see me on Chris Hayes. I hate doing that show. I mean, Chris Hayes is one of my favorite hosts, and I hate doing his show because it's 8 o'clock, and that means that, like, I'm not going to be on the come down for hours, right? Like, it's going to mess up my bedtime if I'm on Hayes, because I'm still so just like, right? That's kind of how I am. My wife jokes that, like, the ear that's on her, my side of the bed, is she's deaf in that ear. Just because I am that guy, like, even after the cameras go off. And it's not, you know, it's not, I 20 years ago I would have said that's not sustainable, but here I am, so.
In that quote, which is for those of you who have, again, had the chance and the pleasure to read the book, this is from chapter 7 on police brutality. And the quote is, again, "My issue is with white people who refuse to keep their goddamn cops on a leash." What kind of obligation does, what obligation does this population, this demographic have? I mean, how do you think about, the book is entitled, subtitled, you know, A Black Guy's Guide to Understanding the Constitution, but so much of it is actually written for this shadow audience, if you will, or auxiliary audience. Like, how do you think about allyship or camaraderie?
It ain't a guide to the Constitution for black guys, right? That's not how the syntax goes, right? I'm trying to get people to see it from my perspective. You don't have to be black to see it from my perspective. You can be white, brown, if a Martian picked up the book, they should be able to see it from my perspective. One of the criticisms that I've gotten from the book is just like, oh, we're not going to convince many people with that language. Man, I'm not trying to convince Republicans. That's like, who can do such things? I'm trying to convince liberals. I'm trying to convince people who are ostensibly on my side what it looks like to fight for my side. So when we talk about allyship, for instance, especially in the police brutality situation, I need your votes, right? I need you to understand like what the problem is. I need you to get out there and vote for it, because too often you don't, right? Like you saw it with the George Floyd protests, and there was a point where like white people were like 62% for like reforming police brutality. I'm like, that's not gonna last. Not gonna last. It's not a part of your everyday. So I have a different babysitter now, but I used to have a Manny take care of, who came in the 4 times before COVID when I was working to kind of be there when the kids got home and take care of them. And like, he called me one day and he's like, I'm sorry, I have to miss work because I just got brutalized by the police. And it's like, in the way that your nanny or caregiver might say, oh, I got strep throat. And I respond, and I, in the first instance, like, oh, well, you know, that happens, man. you got a lawyer, you got, like, and just as if he was talking about strep throat is how that whole situation played out, right? He was black. It's a constant kind of thing. It doesn't have to happen to you, but it happens to somebody that you know. It doesn't happen to somebody that you know, but it happens to somebody that you know's cousin. Like, it's a constant thing in our community that every now and again, one of us is going to get our ass kicked. And what I need from allies is to vote like that could happen to you, or one of your kin, or one of your children, because that's what it's like for me, and that's how I vote. That's how I show up to the polls. That's what I'm looking for. And so that's what I need, but you know, that is always the problem. That's always where we fall down. It's like, if you look at George Floyd, I like to joke, like, where's my George Floyd prize, right? Like, what are the policies that are different, especially on the federal level, because of these protests? Where black people got into the streets for a summer during a pandemic asking for police reform. What have the reforms been? Couple of cities ban chokeholds, kind of. Couple of cities where it's harder to get a no-knock warrant.
Speaking of ass-kicking, can you tell us, this is a really, it's a really vulnerable part of the book where you describe driving in Indiana, one of our neighboring states here in Chicago. Can you recount for our audiences here that story in the context of a really important case? Terry versus Ohio.
So by the way, I used to live in Indiana. I lived in Indianapolis for 13 months, 9 days. I wasn't counting, but like 13 months, 9 days, about 9 hours. My parents split up. I'm from New York. My parents split up before my senior year of high school, and I have family in Indiana. So my mom and my sister and I moved to Indiana, which was, you know, a bit of a culture shock. So now the summer... after we moved, I'm about to go back east for college, but I got a summer job, and my summer job is working for the DMV. And I don't think they do this anymore, but back in the day for the Indianapolis 500, the pace car would like travel throughout Indiana and like go to like diners and stuff, and people would come out, take pictures with the pace car from the race, which, okay, that's a thing, whatever. They paid me to be the advance man for the pace car. So I would go, I had a
ally. I had a white person with me, but like we would go to like, okay, now when the pace car comes in, you're going to go here and it's going to park there. And like I was the advanced guy, right? So anyway, so I'm driving from eastern Indiana to western Indiana late at night, and I stopped in a gas station. I bought some cigarettes because I used to smoke back then. Again, I'm 17, 18, just turned 18, I believe. And, you know, whatever. And I came back out on the road, and this cop is just following me. And, like, you know he's following you because, like, Indiana, these roads are, like, straight and long, and you can tell. So I'm not doing anything wrong. My car is in good order. I'm not speeding, whatever. Cop follows me. I don't know how long he followed me for. It felt like forever. But eventually he passes me. I'm like, yay. And then immediately as soon as he passes me, another cop pulls up right behind me, puts his lights on, pulls me over to the side of the road. And I'm like, you know, this is not my first time. I'm 18, but this is not the first time that this has happened to me. So I figure, like, I'm going to be in for, like, some low-grade, like, police harassment. And I'll be fine, whatever. And the cop kind of puts his nose in my car and smells funny in here. I'm like, what? Smells funny in here. And then I don't remember exactly what I honestly don't. But it was something real, just real snarky. Real just like, it's my car. I just washed my car. Maybe you should try it. You know, something like that. Something that you shouldn't say to a cop. And man, that dude snatched my ass so fast. Like, the tone, my whole, like, demeanor bothered him. Pulled me out. Sir, step out of your vehicle. And whenever the cop says vehicle, you know you're in trouble. I'm like, fuck, right? So, slams my head into the hood. Now he's just yelling at me. Just, we're going to find that smell now. We're going to find your stash, boy. I'm like, my license and registration is right here. I'm not looking for your license. I'm looking for your stash. I'm like, oh, this is terrible. So he drags me to the side of the road, puts his knee on my back, another cop comes. So he had a partner, which I didn't realize in real time. But then another cop comes, and I've come to believe this is the first cop that was tailing me. And the second cop then puts his knee in my back while this first cop is still just, like, screaming at me. And I'm sitting there on the side of the road in Indiana thinking, like, my mom is going to kill me. Because I'm going to die here because I had a smart mouth. And she always told me, don't have that smart mouth, especially not around the country. You can't have your smart mouth. And I had the smart mouth, and this is how I'm going to die. And she's going to be so pissed. Like, I'm like literally in my mind, I'm kind of imagining like an afterlife of my mom yelling at me because I died stupidly on the side of the road in Indiana. I didn't die. Cop got off me. They tossed my car. I mean, it was brutalized. But they let me alone. He didn't even give me a ticket. He didn't even ask for my license. But he got whatever he needed to make himself feel good that day, and they drove off. And I'm still here. It's... And that's like not even the, you know, it's not even the scariest, not even the, there was another story that I didn't put in the book, but it was, I'm in Indiana, now coming back from college, visiting Indiana, and I dropped, my mom was a speech pathologist, and I dropped her off at the school where she was going to do a in-school visit, and I drove to a diner, and on my way from the school to the diner, broad daylight, this cop stops me, and is just like, well, you know, we just don't get a lot of people look like you around here. I was like, yeah, well, if you go to the school, you'll find another person looks just like me, I'm told. He was like, all right, well, that's okay. Hey, by the way, thank you for being so decent about it. Thank you for being so decent about it. And I was decent about it because of what had happened to me years earlier. I knew how to be decent.
One of the ways in which this personal anecdote gets rendered in the book is that you correlate it to Terry. So let me, I'll give the context. So there's a really important legal case called Terry versus Ohio. And as you explore in the book, one of the key distinctions, why this is so important in American history, is the way in which there's a distinction made between reasonable suspicion on the one hand and probable cause.
Yeah. So, yes, thank you for reminding me about the law here. So, probable cause is like a legal standard that says, like, to arrest somebody, the officer has to have, you know, X, Y, and Z before they can make an arrest. But a reasonable suspicion is the legal standard they have to use to stop you. And reasonable suspicion is something less than probable cause, but has to be more than a hunch. And I have no idea what that means. I know what the cop thinks it means. The cop thinks it means anytime they see a black person doing something wrong, they suspect is wrong, they can stop. And the way that this case comes down, this is an 8-1 decision. The case is called Terry v. Ohio, the case that allows a cop to stop and search people based on a reasonable suspicion as opposed to probable cause. That was an 8-1 case by the Earl Warren uber-liberal court, written by uber-liberal Earl Warren, signed onto by Thurgood Marshall, first black Supreme Court justice. 8-1 saying, yes, of course, cops have to be able to do this.
Argued by two black lawyers, too.
What?
Was it?
Yes, so the Terry v. Ohio case is also, it was the first case that where two black attorneys argued in front of the Supreme Court, in front of the first black justice. The prosecutor was black of Terry, who was a black man, and the defense attorney was a black man named Louis Stokes. Now, if you know anything about Ohio history, Louis Stokes would go on to become the first African-American congressperson from Ohio. And he, in real time, said that Thurgood Marshall and all of them were wrong. He knew it in real time, and he kept saying it until the day he died. He knew that case was wrong because he knew what that case would turn into. If you look at the actual facts of Terry v. Ohio, they observed Terry walking, casing a joint, essentially, walking six times back and forth in front of a storefront. Each time, each circuit, stopping to talk to two people who would be his accomplices, and then doing the circuit again. The cop observed that over the course of half an hour, I believe, before stopping Terry. That was Thurgood Marshall's reasonable suspicion. Not, I smelled something in your car, boy, while you were going 45 miles an hour down a highway in the middle of the night. But Louis Stokes knew that if you gave cops an inch, if you gave cops that inch, they would take a mile. And that reasonable suspicion would devolve from that high Warren Marshall standard to Giuliani time, which is exactly what happened. So if you want to then unpack, remember, folks, racial profiling is already illegal. Racial profiling is already unconstitutional. We don't need a new constitutional amendment or a law or whatever to say that it's illegal to subject people to a heightened sense of suspicion because of their race. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment does all that work for us. What's non-illegal is these stops based on alleged reasonable suspicion. Is being black a reasonable suspicion even of itself? Well, they can't say that in court, but in practice, on the ground, that's what it turns out to be.
There are a lot of actors in the political arena, or the legal arena at least, or especially rather, and much of the book focuses on legal cases, important legal cases. But you mentioned a moment ago, in reference to George Floyd, that not enough has been done at the federal level, and. There's a moment early in the book where you're talking about William Rehnquist and the little kind of switcheroo tactic he does between the 14th and the 4th Amendment. Let me read a quote to you, and this is also in the context of him saying, I love the phrase, it's also disturbing how quotidian it is, but you said, I was experiencing a kind of low-grade form of police harassment. I mean, I don't know if that we should ever be comfortable with a low-grade form of police harassment. But later on in the book, you note, in really chilling detail, the varying possibility of anything called police brutality. It's that kind of violence is already sanctioned by the state. It can't exist philosophically. It can't exist in actual terms. That there is no such thing as excess when it comes to police violence, and in fact, it's not even violence. It's just the exertion of their power guaranteed by the state. But let me read to you this quote where you do talk about the Department of Justice as a form of recourse or a site of recourse. Without the 14th Amendment protections that Rehnquist ripped away, there's no longer a great way for individual victims of police brutality to bring racial discrimination claims against the police. Instead, that work now largely falls to the Department of Justice. Say a little bit more about the individual versus the social.
So let's start here. The problem is federalism, right? The problem is, and it goes back to the racist, misogynist, rapist founders, they thought that the best way to do this was to have not one centralized federal government, but 13 sovereign, essentially sovereign nations all feeding into some general federal power. We call that federalism. That is why, for instance, we have 50 state election systems as opposed to just one like a rational country, right? Well, when in the policing situation, it's not just that we have 50 different police units for all 50 states. We have something close to 3,000 different police entities in this country, sheriff's departments or county boards, who have some level of control over police use of force. And to change how police use their force, because of federalism, because the police power is explicitly reserved to the states under our Constitution, we don't just have to change one law or two laws, we have to change 3,000 laws, you know, across the country in all 50 states to really get change in how police use and execute their force in this country. That's hard. That's hard. So what happens is that we over-rely in some instances on the Department of Justice to bring what's called pattern and practice investigations against individual states or individual police departments or individual counties, right? To say that the pattern and practice of your policing is violative of this constitutional principle or that, violative of equal protection, violative of the Fourth Amendment, whatever. Because that's the only, that's the easiest way in our current system to get police departments to play ball. So when the head of the Department of Justice switches from Democrats to Republicans, and when you have a guy like Jeff Sessions say that, well, they're not going to enforce or even seek consent decrees anymore, what a consent decree is that Department of Justice coming down to your local office and saying, like, that's too racist even for us. And so when Jeff Sessions says, we're not going to do that anymore, what he's saying is, no holds barred. Go nuts. The federal government won't stop you. And that's a huge, I mean, there's so many problems in our country that go to my mind, go back to federalism, but this is one of the chiefest. And it's also one of the reasons, I just want to say really quickly, in my travels, it is one of the reasons why I find, why it is difficult for me to get other black people, other African Americans, as focused on the federal courts, the Supreme Court, and the circuit courts, and whatever, as the Republicans are, right? Because if you're African American, if you're living, especially if you're living in an over-policed, under-resourced community, the judges that you're seeing every day, it ain't Sam Alito, right? He's not coming in, putting your cousin in jail. It's some state court judge. It's the state court system. It's some local law enforcement, not federal law enforcement. No, there are very few black people who have been stopped by the FBI, all right? But like a bunch of black people in here have been harassed by CPD. A bunch of black people where I live have been harassed by NYPD, right? And so to try to get people to like focus on the federal issues, like the FBI, like the Supreme Court, when it's the local issues that are kind of keeping people down today, like that's a big challenge that Democrats have, I think, and liberals have when trying to get people to focus on the courts. And all of that goes back to federalism as well.
So we have just a few more minutes here. I'm going to kind of prefigure two questions that rely upon metaphors, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. You know, Ali, like you mentioned a moment ago that one problem that you have is the issue of federalism. And in the book, another big problem that you have with the Constitution, and I love this metaphor, is that it's like a video game that like Nintendo was competing with, Sega, okay, Sony, Xbox. And so they released a video game and they knew they had to do a software update like the next day. So the Constitution was hastily written, it was rushed, you're right, it was in sweltering heat over the summertime. When we read this in American history, the glories of the Continental Congress, great minds came together and they produced this magnificent document. But in the book, one of the kind of latent arguments is that the amendments function to the Constitution like the software update or patch functions to the game software. And so should we be focusing more on the software patch, the amendment part of the Constitution, rather than...
Absolutely. The amendments are where all the rights are, right? The baseline Constitution, Article 1, 2, 3, like what you're reading there is structure, right? And there are lots of structural problems, right? We're going to have a Senate that's not representative of the people. That's dumb. We're not going to properly elect the president. That's super dumb, right? But it's structural stuff. It's the amendments where you find your right to free speech or your right to religion or your right against search and seizure. And so absolutely we should be focusing on those amendments. But here's the thing. Let me tell you something about the amendment process. An amendment is worth nothing if conservatives on the Supreme Court don't like it. And I don't care what party they're in. Today, the conservatives call themselves Republicans. After the Civil War, the conservatives call themselves Democrats. I don't care what conservatives call themselves in the morning. That's not my problem. But whatever they're calling themselves, it is the conservatives who do the bad stuff. And I can prove that by looking at the 15th Amendment, right? Whole war, fought this war. Good guys won-ish. And we get these Reconstruction Amendments, and one of them is the 15th Amendment, which guarantees the right to vote will not be abridged on the basis of race, color, or creed. And it took a little bit while longer because, again, even though they were willing to give the vote to black men, they weren't willing to give the vote to women. So it took us a little longer to get to the 19th Amendment, which finally gave the vote to women. It took us even longer to get to the point where black women could vote, but we won't talk about that. Bottom line, we got this amendment that says that everybody could vote. And conservatives on the Supreme Court said, interesting. I'm going to put that in the drawer and ignore it for 100 years. That's what they did to the 15th. They just straight up ignored it. They pretended like it didn't exist until the 1965 Voting Rights Act. I do not start the clock on America as a democracy until the 1965 Voting Rights Act. I argue that the 1965 Voting Rights Act is the most important piece of legislation in American history by far, because it's the first piece of legislation that even attempted to grant universal suffrage in this country. The Voting Rights Act was so impactful that in one generation, in about 40 years, you go from an oppressed people who don't even have the right to sit in the front of the bus to electing the first black president. 40 years from the Voting Rights Act to President Obama, right? What do white people do next? Okay, so Obama wins in 2008. Then he gets reelected in 2012. The 2012 reelection is important because it proves that it wasn't a fluke, right?
Obama's known around these parts, by the way.
Right? You heard of him, right? Good hair, really well-spoken, clean. So we get 2012, proves that he's not a fluke, and the very next thing that white conservatives do is take away the Voting Rights Act. 2013, Shelby County v. Holder, 5-4, John Roberts cuts the legs out from under the Voting Rights Act in 2013. So before you had Trump, before you had the escalator man, before you had Mexicans are rapists, before any of that, John Roberts was like, can't let those black people vote, because look what happens. The amendment is worth nothing if you don't have justices on the Supreme Court willing to enforce it, and that has been true for our entire history. What's the first case to be brought under the 13th Amendment? It was by white people. It was by white butchers. The state of Louisiana had granted a monopoly on butchering to one company, and white butchers in Louisiana, New Orleans, were like, That means we have to work for that company. That's like slavery. That's like involuntary servitude. This monopoly is illegal under the 13th Amendment. And the Supreme Court said, no. The 13th Amendment is only for the slave race. That's what they called us. And so right from the beginning, conservative justices cut the legs out from the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment could be a whole different thing about economic rights. That's what some people thought they were doing, but white conservatives on the Supreme Court, no, that's not what we're doing today. Your amendment is worth nothing if you don't have the justices to back it up.
This will be the last question here. Folks who have questions, you can feel free to line up over here where there's a microphone next to Allison. The last metaphor here. In the book, you write that the Constitution is like jazz. So what kind of jazz are we hearing right now? Bebop, hard bop, smooth jazz?
Right now, it's more like we're hearing Wagner, right? We're just hearing a lot of authoritarian, Hayato! Like, we're in trouble. But, yeah, it's supposed to be Coltrane, right? It's supposed to be, here's the beat. You got the beat. All right, now we're going to go do a little bit of this. Now we're going to do a little bit of that. But always around the same beat. Blah, 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 blah. Right? The idea that the law is stable is just not true. It's not supposed to be. We live in an adversarial system. The law is supposed to be an argument. You make your argument, and I make my argument, and the best argument wins, and that's how we move forward, and that's how it's supposed to be, and that's why the conservatives are so invested in ossifying the Constitution, in limiting the Constitution, not to the winner of the current argument, because they can't win the current argument. They want to ossify it in the ideas of long-dead slavers, because they can't win the argument. So that's why they're trying to do what they're trying to do, and that's why I reject that out of hand. I'm fine. Like, you can make an argument like Thurgood Marshall made that reasonable suspicion is what the cops need to have the ability to stop people based on reasonable suspicion. I disagree with that argument, but you can make that argument and you can win that argument. That's fine. What you can't do is tell me, well, Thomas Jefferson would. I don't care what Thomas Jefferson thought. That doesn't matter. What matters is what's the best argument for our society moving forward, and that's what the law is supposed to be able to do.
So, I mean, we heard it here. The Constitution sounds like John Coltrane. on behalf of the American Writers Museum, I want to thank him for joining us this afternoon here in Chicago, and thank again the audience for joining us on this panel. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Ashley C. Ford discusses her memoir, Somebody's Daughter, with Eve L. Ewing, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.